Now, the difference, now, if we can do this, this job can be done in 5 years, or it can be done in 2 and 3/4 or 3 years. And the only catalyst that it takes to take it from the 5 years to the 3 years with all the concomitant savings is the catalyst of your saying that you'd like to see it done. And what you get from that is what they call more risk. I don't know what the risk is, really. We get more risk, but you get the saving of not having spent 5 years to do it.
Well, I'll take a hard look at it. I did. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for reading.
Good to see you.
Somebody will pick you up here with all your rich home builders.
to their problems. That's very kind of you, sir. It's an exceptionally busy week for you. I'm a father who's had a daughter married.
Uh-oh.
And all I can wish you is all happiness. And I can't depart. I know I've done too.
Down. In fact, they're a little bit too high now.
and pass it to Arthur to give him an auditor.
$1 million during that year made the difference between a disaster and a pretty respectable year. And
more important, as we see it, made it possible for us to respond instantly to the supply of money which appeared at the front end of this year, and begin producing houses at the level that we're producing them. Now, if we had been allowed to get, you know, hammered into the ground during 1970, we wouldn't have been able to respond as quickly as we have. We have quite a productive capacity, and we can produce well over the 2 million number. We are pleased to say that, you know, starts now at 903,000. The supply of money, again, because of your attitude toward inflation, has grown to a kind of record heights. And yet, this is one of the sources of our problems. Savings and loans and mutual savings banks, which are the principal sources of money historically for housing, in their best year before this year, in the first 5 months of the year, in 1967, accumulated $6 billion in savings inflow. This year, in the first 5 months, they've already gone to $18 billion. And while the starts, Mr. President, are at 1,903,000 now, we're concerned because the marketplace is very precarious. The sales from the past month have fallen markedly. Starts are a function of sales. Now, there's a lag,
sure,
in terms of sales to starts. And the effect of the sale fall off this past month won't be felt for some time, but it's there. And we're afraid about what the money situation can do to us. In spite of the supply of money, the kind of panic that's occurring in the money market is incomprehensible, and, you know, I'm not going to make any conjecture about what started in the European situation or whatever, but at a certain point, and in spite of the Fed's response to that European situation and pumping money into the economy, and in spite of the announcement made by industry within the past few days that their spending in this year is going to be substantially lower than some of us had anticipated, and that their competition for money in the marketplace, which crushed us last year and the year before, is not going to be important. There's a panic in the money market. The mortgage bankers, many of them, have been holding 7% mortgages and anticipating what could have been a drop in the interest rate. It could have gone down another half point. You're right, it should have. But at a certain point, it seems like everyone decided to storm Fannie Mae and make offers that drove the points from 3, sometimes 2, clear up to 9 in some cases.
And let's storm S2, John.
Yes.
And last week, we began to put together a statement that I thought I might issue this afternoon. I went in the process of checking the Treasury and CEA. Right now, with respect to statements, this reflects my own basic conviction about this. There's been a lot of speculation in recent weeks that has had an unfortunate effect on mortgage interest rates and mortgage lending activities, which threatens to cut short the current expansion and how it starts. The effects are unfortunate because they're based on what I consider to be a misreading of underlying financial conditions. Financial markets, in particular the bond markets, are clearly in a state of flux. And when I say the figures on corporate bonds, the way they've been up and down, and you know, they've been
right
doing this. This volatility of interest rates should be reason enough for lenders and investors to be cautious in placing too much weight on the most recent trends. I thought at the time, and I believe in even more strongly today, that the recent upward trend pushed corporate bond yields to an artificially high level. Thus, I have made no move to adjust the FHA interest rate ceiling. I believe that the ceiling must be flexible both upward and downward. But so long as it remains subject to my administrative discretion, adjustments will be based on my reading of underlying conditions, not on what I consider to be temporary aberrations. Clearly, the volatility of the market conditions in recent weeks has been obscuring the underlying situation. I won't read the whole end of it, all of it, but, and this has got to be boiled down a bit. But developments now in train will, I believe, gradually permit more realistic assessment of the basic strength of the market, the mortgage market. In these circumstances, I continue to see no reason for any precipitous change in the FHA interest rate ceiling. Now, it seems to me the statement of that type this afternoon could be a very healthy thing in quieting this market situation. Because there have been too many loose statements made here recently by some people who shouldn't have been talking.
Exactly.
All right. And they shouldn't have been talking.
You put it out yourself. Comment.
Yeah, we're all right. Okay. All right.
Very good. But I wanted to be, that's the tone, that's the end. We're not going to be, I mean, trying to build a fluctuation. you really have a situation there where the country's producing 11% of the GNP of the world, in fact, in the free world, like we're affecting countries producing 89%, because they were slightly overvalued or maybe somewhat of undervalued. And so the question is whether the 11% or the 89% is in trouble. You see, my point is, but it has its effect. It creates constant creates warbles here and there. And of course, there's always a bunch of pirates in Wall Street and other places that want to zoom in and that make money every time there's a change. They don't make money when things go up normally, but they make money when there's enormous fluctuations in gangsters
in the money markets.
And I have nothing but contempt for them. As far as they're concerned, we're not going to have our policies affected by people that aren't moving in that direction.
Well, we agree, Mr. President, and on that point, we feel that the Fannie Mae auction, which is an answer this week, is going to be useful in picking up those sevens. We've got a lot of people panicking.
However,
but we're getting out before that.
That's the point.
We feel number one, if the price paid for those mortgages can somehow be kept up at some reasonable level, 96 probably. And if Fannie Mae can be convinced that they, at this point, should remember their public purpose and not go out to make a, you know, that 100 basis point markup on the purchase of these mortgages, we think that would be very helpful.
Well, for the first time, Fannie Mae failed to support quite as fully as it should have. And that's
added
a little bit here. Right. And we've registered, in fact, and that's one reason you've got this special auction tomorrow. To try and compensate for what was a little weakness for a few weeks.
Your reference to the bond markets is fortunate, because when you add insurance companies and commercial banks to the two institutions I have mentioned, you've got $46 billion for the first 5 months as compared to the best year before, which was at about $20 billion. And so the money is there.
That's right.
And the adjustment has got to take place.
To some extent, this is a result of the fact that financial circles have been talking for months now about interest rates picking up in the last half. And it's almost fed on it. So
sure.
It seems to be knocked out.
And inevitably brings it about.
Yeah,
I'm talking about.
We've been living with this business of the
also, it means that money isn't going to go out of the present rates. They're going to wait until it comes out.
That's what's happening. The savings loan are not making money available the way they did.
Right.
That's what's happening.
Right, well, they've seen the points developed at Fannie Mae, and they've decided, well, if they can get that kind of money for their money, let's do it too.
Yeah.
It's an artificial situation. I think steps have been taken in Fannie Mae to start to cure it. They put some restrictions back on it. We've been living with this business of what the cost of money does to the sale and production of housing. And, the half-point rate increase, which could happen when so many people are clamoring for it, is going to have some interesting effects on the economy. We look at Mr. Mazzell's figure, we look at the figures that our economists have developed on the effect of a half-point increase in the mortgage market. And remember that all during the past 2 years, we were especially frustrated when we saw the number of people in that middle category, the people whose incomes were too high to allow them to qualify for assistance, and yet too low to qualify for that 7.5% and 8.5% mortgage, who were literally, deprived of an opportunity to get into housing. Now, obviously, the other ones are going to get hit. That's middle of American people. The Mazzell study and our economists indicate that a 0.5% increase in the cost of mortgage money is going to cause a loss from housing starts at somewhere between 75,000 and 100,000 units. I might say that that number gets progressively larger as the rate goes up. This is from 7 to 7.5. From 7.5 to 8, the loss is even more phenomenal. We have fought by market psychology, Mr. President, during the months when the rate was extremely high. I had many conferences with Secretary Romney saying, if we could somehow get that thing down to 6 and 7/8, there are people who have metal locks, they just cannot afford to go out and buy money at those prices. Now, if the thing goes up to 7.5, the good Lord only knows how many units we're going to lose to that psychology, which is sure there. And it's expressed in the inflow of savings into the institutions which are accumulating. Mr. Mazzell says that 150,000 jobs will be lost if that interest rate climbs a half a point. He says that the direct dollar loss is affecting $350 million, and the indirect total is more like $3 billion. We look at the Consumer Price Index,
conducted in March, it was noted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that a 0.5% decrease in interest rate caused a 0.2% monthly decrease in the consumer price index. Now, if a 0.5% increase causes a 0.2% increase, then the annual effect will be to take the 3.6 number, which is presently the annual adjusted rate, and move it up to 6, and that's horrendous. I appreciate the attitude that you expressed, Mr. Secretary, and I know what you're feeling, Mr. President. And you know, if there is some way that we can help, we would like to know.
Well, this problem, of course, is enormously affected by these people that really make their money, who produce nothing, and make their money off of fluctuations. The value of money, this is the international banker type, and all that, whether they're in Switzerland or New York, or wherever they may be. So something goes up and down, and then they go up and down. Now, what happens there is that you get them, they say, well, everything happens to them. International monetary situation, they don't tend to see always blame the United States. And the United States is supposed to be putting itself into the ring, regardless of what our problems may be, in order to help them. We're not, that is not what we're going to do. First of all, this economy is sound, this dollar is sound, and the worst thing that could happen for the world economy is for the United States not to have a continuing upturn in its economy. We intend to have a continuing upturn. Essentially, the upturn is a strong home building industry. And essentially, the strong home building industry are low, shall we, well, what's rather than low, we'll say interest rates that people are willing to pay. Interest rates that will not drive purchases away. That is our policy. Now, we deal here in a free economy with lots of people who have different views. I think the stock market, for a reason, we all understand that. Would make more money than if they put everyone up. And others, of course, are maybe not be as concerned as we are about the economy in this particular direction. But we're headed along this line. Economies are the way to go all the rest of us. And we have in mind the fact of what government can do, where private decisions by the thousands are involved. We're still going to move in that direction.
Well, sir, your second new issue following our last meeting with you in January 70 had a dramatic effect not only on the guys in our industry who kept alive, but on the whole attitude toward us. Your being part of you, the Secretary of State, we've heard, is going to be great for this situation. If you bring a couple of 3 weeks of peace and tranquility, so that order can resume its supply and demand can take over again, able to accomplish a very important task.
May I ask
one other thing? Excuse me, Nat. Shortly after we presented a problem to the White House in a letter to you and in a conference with Mr. Schultz, developing the cost of lumber, we had a task force at work on the subject, and it became known that there was a task force at work that included members of the Council of Economic Advisors. In fact, as this lumber prices level off, I give this to you, gentlemen, for what it's worth, but you have a very effective operation here. And sometimes.
Well, you were going to suggest a task force this money.
Yes.
On interest rates and see what the problem is. What I was going to ask is whether Mr. Romney's statement.
Well, we could have a task force working on it right now.
The president asked for the statement.
The statement could be. Could include the fact that you have discussed this matter with the president. It would give it even more weight.
Yes, certainly can. I'll say this is a matter that has been discussed with the president. It approves the statement. And I would also add the Secretary's situation. It's very important. He should get to deal with the president. The Secretary of the Treasury approved the statement. This represents administration policy.
Mr. President, you claim to be here stretching this for collective bargaining. I'm grateful for your time.
send Davis Bank, and we support it vigorously. When you issue to executive order, they support the flight plan. We have some concerns, however, that the effectiveness of that executive order, which we think could work, especially in the face of what we think are possible problems with the imposition of wage and price controls in one industry and an entire economy. And I know what your opinion is about wage and price controls overall. We think the executive order can work, but we think it's not being given a chance to work for the simple reason that deferred increases built into contracts, which were signed before the Wage Stabilization Committee came to be, are not being reviewed by that committee. Now, these increases violate, in most cases, the guidelines set up, and even the liberalized version of the guidelines. Liberalized when adjustments are made for equity adjustments, but the deferred increases in many cases are pure and simple violations of those guidelines. And not only make it impossible to argue against a new contract at a reasonable level, but we're afraid that those deferred increases are going to be used for the basis of equity adjustment increases, and that's going to throw the whole thing clear out of whack. It's going to compound the problem. Now, the fact is that it's almost academic because so many of the contracts have already gone into effect. As we see it, it's almost impossible to do any rolling back. But if those remaining few are yet to be reviewed, yet to become effective, would be subject to a review where the deferred increases violate those guidelines, we think that it would give validity to the executive order.
Let me talk about that for a moment. Yeah. You are tentative to not get a flat amount, as you know, but to provide for some adjustment because of this ongoing situation, as you mentioned. And the arrangement that was made to have the parties participate in reviewing and handling the problem of the ongoing increases was very specific. We've got two criteria. First, try to get it back to a common base and then make adjustments above that common base on accordance with comparisons of crafts in like areas or same crafts in different areas. That kind of thing. Now that was a specific claim made with the parties themselves. And we all put all that is in there about deferred increases is that there can't be a review of it. There is no club to that. There is no control. There are no approval requirements to divert increases. And any indication you may have from anybody that is incorrect because the understanding at the outset that that is not correct. You see, all they have to do is review it. But we did put the purpose and the fact that you could review it in there for two reasons. One, we knew there were some what we call balloon kind of things at the end of some of these contracts that even union stuff were ill-advised and wanted to get, do something about. So we put it in for that reason. Second, to enable the committee, the Stabilization Committee, now as it looks at the ongoing increases, to ignore increases of an excessive amount, or they say unreasonably inconsistent with that order, in setting ongoing rates. And that's what they're doing. And let me tell you what that thing's accomplishing so far. The highest rate has been approved by that is 13%. The lowest is low as zero. And the cluster, the great cluster, is between 6 and 9. And I'll tell you right now, between you and I, that's better than I thought we'd be able to do with this. What it's doing, it's coming down from a 16% level that had constantly gone up every quarter. We've broken the back system. And we can only hang so much weight on this thing and continue to make it work. Now, we cannot, and we have not, in the terms of the executive order itself, any power to tell anybody that negotiated a legal contract that they cannot pay that contract. That's not against the order. That's right. So we have to, what we can do is what we can talk them into in the committee. And the committee has set up a review procedure for this purpose. It has set who can promote or bring to the attention of the committee that, and that can be done by not only the parties themselves, but by associations, by your association, by government agencies, like some of our own government agencies. But I don't want you to think that we have the same power, or anywhere near the same kind of power, to deal with the question of deferred increases than we do with others. But it isn't there. But and if we try to put it there, we break back the whole thing, and you won't have the gains that have been made now.
But in the order, you use the terminology.
review process, but it goes through the boards and then through the committee, you see.
Well,
and obviously, the first order of business for us was to get the grips on the current contracts being negotiated. And I must say that instead of being a little bit less than 16%, that some of us thought we'd be able to come to them, so far it's significantly less. And give it a chance to work, John. It's going to work a lot.
I certainly shall. I want very much for it to work. We'll stay in touch. One other item, Mr. President, and I must say, before I get into this, that we have had most sympathetic treatment. Secretary Silverman, Secretary Hodgson, and this here again, especially when they learned, and Mr. Silverman learned from me, that regulations which were designed for heavy construction, talk about safety, for the administration of the Safety Standards Act of 1969, were about to be imposed on housing and light construction, although during the 18 months that those regulations were put together, we had no input, and that they were designed for heavy construction. Mr. Stokes reacted immediately and brought about a time during which we could gather some input and provide it. We have, from the very beginning, asked for the establishment of a committee to establish standards and regulations for the 70 Act, which was passed and which includes our industry, because we feel that, you know, housing is sufficiently different than the business which builds 40-story buildings or bridges or dams. And especially at this point in our production history, not at this point in our economy, should be treated as a separate industry. It's a very difficult thing to define, you know, a part of the total construction industry as something different than another segment of it. But it's there. It's reflected in the unemployment comp rates. It's reflected in the insurance rates. It's reflected in the record itself. Our concern is not only for the slowdown that can be affected, but the fact that our present estimates indicated additional costs, unnecessary additional costs, to somewhere between $500 and $1,000 per housing unit or apartment. Now, that $1,000 could have just about half the effect in terms of number of units, number of dollars, number of jobs that that half rate of interest is going to have that we were talking about. And we're deeply concerned. We have been given a sympathetic year, but the time is so short. These regulations are promulgated or supposed to go into effect August 27th. And the time is so short, and we've not been told yet that a committee will be appointed. We think the committee should be appointed not only to oversee the creation of regulations, but hopefully to sit for a year to make sure that that makes sense in their application to our industry. And we would beg your understanding and assistance in that area.
Well, I should mention about this, Mr. President, that one of the things that this industry has a problem in connection with safety regulations, they got two laws that apply to them. We had the Construction Safety Act back in 1969, and that was followed by the act that this year we've been trying to work with the people in the industry to make sure one didn't get in the way of the other, or they have any duplicate responsibilities or duties in connection with it. We've also got a problem with handling this thing to protect the industry from having the kind of accusations that have been made about the coal industry regarding the Coal Mine Safety Act, that we're not pursuing aggressively the establishment of the requirements in this industry. We had the Undersecretary meet with representatives of the industry. As a result of that meeting, deferred the application of the provision of the Construction Safety Act, new standards that we've set under that, until next August, then have asked for a list of exceptions that they would like to take to them. I understand, John, you are coming up with a list of exceptions.
Yes.
You come up with a list of exceptions. At that time, we'll work out some way to be with them through consultations through a committee or some such thing as that to take a look at that. But you're going to have to watch out, John, that we don't get into the kind of situation where the Naders and the Jack Andersons get to look at your industry and start working over the way they've done the others. And once they do that, then we're both in a supervision. And that's the thing that we're trying to watch out.
Yeah, Mr. Secretary, in the same sense that we have sometimes been bruised by kind of being blended in with any construction, for example, in collective bargaining, where the cost of housing goes soaring beyond any sensible limits and doesn't have to, because
course of collective bargaining that we're not, you know, party to, but the heavy construction, we face the danger again of being kind of watered into something that where we don't belong. And it could have a serious effect on us.
Do I gather you're going to be able to come up with something pretty
sure? Oh, we sure are. But I'm not so sure that the definition that I've been asked for is something that is going to be convincing. You know, how do you define one specialty in the law from another? And not come up with the answer, a lawyer is a lawyer is a lawyer. We're trying to take a right. One other thing, Mr. President, we came to ask, knowing all of the political realities of the day, knowing what your experience has been with the Congress in session, if there's any possibility of your support for reasonable, sensible labor relations reform legislation.
Let me be quite candid on that. I just make it the number one priority of the White House, third in prayer. I mean, let's be quite candid. There isn't one chance at all of anything. First of all, you'd never get out of committee. Both committees are disaster areas, utter disaster areas. I speak as one who served in the Labor Committee with the little Jeff Harvey 23 years ago. They're disaster areas. They will consider nothing except something that gives more to basically the interests on the union side. And, for example, just take this old business of transportation. I mean, you had this railroad strike, this mess, you've got the seamen and the rest. We've had it for a year and a half, a bill to do something about this. These characters haven't even given it a hearing. Now they said they're going to give it a hearing, but they aren't going to do one damn thing. The Labor Committee's in the House, and the present Democratic leadership in the House and Senate, Albert in the House will never allow anything to come out except it's 100% pro-labor. And the same is true of Mansfield in the Senate. So if your committees won't let it come out, that means that people in the feud, if you could get a majority with the Republicans, or at least a majority of the Republicans voting with Southern Democrats, that's the only way you get a majority. You might get it if you had it up and down and vote on that. First of all, you get a chance to vote. The committees will never bring it out. All right, the committees don't get it out. How does it else get out? The leaders got to bring it out. Mansfield on the one side, Albert and the rest are totally in the pocket of the labor unions. Totally. Albert, Mansfield, because he's always there. And that's part of his background. And Albert, because he's got breathing down his neck in his own leadership. The people that are very far on that side. Now that's the political reality. I can sit here and tell you, look, boys, we're going to go out and fight for something. We're going to submit or something. And let me say, I think it needs to be done. I think that the present labor-management relationships, and this is looking at Taft Hartley, and what followed years later, Land and Grant, which become just a piece of it, that all of this basically is not, that needs an essential overhaul. I would say this in George meeting, we're sitting here, he knows how I feel, we disagree on this particular item, but there is no way you can do anything about it until you change Congress. You give us a few more congressmen, a few more senators, and I don't care whether they're Democrats or Republicans, the people that will stand up and be counted on this issue, we can do something, and something needs to be done. See, this is like what it is with Heath in England, where he's grabbed these people going about as far as our damn target goes, but that's a long way from where they were. Here you see you've got that system, the parliamentary system of government, where if the leader determines something, you go out and do it, even though the popularity of it is very, very low. I think at this time, the majority of the people in the country would support some labor management reform. I think the Congress probably on a close vote final, but the present Democratic leadership in the labor committees will kill it without a trace, and they'll be joined by most of the Republicans on those committees as well. And the present Democratic leadership of the House and the Senate will never take it from the committees and bring it to the floor in their head. Well, that's what it is. That's what the bark off, but you ought to hear it straight. I mean, all this other, that's just nonsense. I wish it were otherwise, it's not true. I'll tell you this. Once we get a change in that Congress, there's going to be some more legislation. There needs to be. It'll be fair. It'll be like the legislation we have in this field of the transportation, which incidentally ought to be done. In other words, in that field, which of course is very different from yours, you've got to have some sort of basis where you keep the railroads going and the ships running and so forth and so on. Secretary of Labor may not want to hear this, or he may want to hear it when his constituency won't. But I'll be damned if I'm going to appoint a labor lawyer to that job. That's what it's going to be. We have labor lawyers in that job for years.
Yes.
And they have every right to represent their constituency. But it's time to have some more even-handed decisions from the NLRB. The NLRB is a goddamn disaster area. And I said, I'm an expert in this field. I know what I'm talking about. I slaved over Taft Hartley for 2 years, or maybe a year and a half. A year, when we were having the hearings, a year after the defendant. And anybody that stands here and tells me NLRB is fair, let me prove it. It is not. Most of the decisions are, but it's loaded very heavily. And it's not loaded because of the members of the NLRB. They don't amount to anything being fair. They start to get people appointments because they only want to be on some damn commission. And the key thing is the staff. And the key thing is the general counsel. The lawyers, whether we may say lawyers, Big Bad News is one as an icon. The damn lawyers run most of the agencies. And in this case, we're going to have a lawyer over there. He isn't going to be somebody far right who's just out to bust unions. By God, it's not going to be a guy that is recommended by leaders. But we're going to have a lawyer who's going to be fair for a change as head of the general counsel. You don't know who it is, but by God, you're going to have one. Very good. Well, I have a question. So thank you very much. Yeah. And that secretary will support that. He wants to fair the other.
I'm sure he does.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. What I just said about this is off the record.
Oh, yes.
And the other part, the part about the appointment is off because I'll make that decision in the next couple of weeks, and I don't want to give some of our opponents a chance to kick in before I do that.
Ron Ziegler suggested that this thing might well be issued here as a result of the meeting.
Very good.
So what I propose to do is to see if we can get Chair Frazier and get this language down. Kick it out of here before you get away. If you want to take a minute, I'll let you take a look at it and see if you can probably get a cigarette.
Yeah.
Thanks, Larry.
Good job.
Why don't you go to see where we stand with Frazier.
I just didn't work it out at least. I was over here.
You're going to say,